everyone. This is Lacey here on the Your Line Matters podcast, and I'm fortunate to be here with Alex, and she's all the way from Ottawa, Ontario. This is the second episode of the Your Line Matters podcast. Hi, Alex. Thanks for joining.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for inviting
Appreciate
me.
you're welcome. It's my pleasure, and I've been waiting for this for a while, so thank you for being on here.
I am honored to be on here. I'm so excited
Awesome.
and thankful that you're doing this too.
Oh, awesome to hear. Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm going to give people a little bit of a summary as to how I met Alex. Alex actually found me after she listened to a podcast episode that I was interviewed on, the Tick Boot Camp podcast. So, want to tell us anything about that, Alex? Did you just kind of search and find me that way, or?
I now and again had really a Facebook community when I was going through the worst of the treatments, and even after, and was excited to hear that because, I think podcasts and listening to tapes and was one of the main ways of gaining information when I was really, really sick. And even now, to some extent, just because of the difficulty I was having with reading and processing information. So I really like to listen to podcasts. So I came across yours and it was really interesting. And you're from Canada and I was like, wow, this is great. So
And when you say Canada, that is one of the goals, is to sort of bridge some of the gaps and interconnectedness. That's some of my podcast values. Definitely, I'm looking so forward to hearing your story, and I know a tiny, tiny bit about it from previous conversations. And I feel that you've definitely got a message to share with people that they can possibly connect with. And so I won't spoil everything right at the start, but I will say we'll talk about some really real life things that we all go through battling Lyme and co-infections. And well, yeah, I mean, with that being said, Alex, do you mind sort of starting us off? Like, well, a lot of us go through this lengthy process while we wait for proper diagnosis. So I guess first off, do you remember being bitten by a tick or anything like that?
I don't. So I don't remember actually seeing a tick. I do know I was at a cottage and I was having strange symptoms that I've never experienced in my life. I had my right arm was tingly, it was turning numb, just really weird sensations in my right arm. And I also had a little rash, circular rash, just underneath my arm, like near my armpit. And so I suspected that I could have had Lyme disease or been bitten by a tick or a spider or something. But when I went to see professionals, and I asked everybody that I saw, when I returned from the cottage, within a 48-hour span, I saw four different doctors. I saw my GP's clinic, saw two doctors there initially. I'm in the notes saying, could this be Lyme disease? Because that was probably the first thing that came to my mind, even though I didn't see a tick, and was told that it couldn't be because it wasn't a bullseye rash.
Oh.
So I was having, because of the strange symptoms I've never had on my right side, on my arm, I went to emergency that night and saw a doctor there. And then I saw a specialist the next day at the hospital, and it was diagnosed as cellulitis.
Okay,
And
cellulitis.
yeah, and
Hey.
I had enough, was given enough antibiotics to get rid of the initial symptoms of the strange sensation in my arm, but not enough, obviously, to actually eradicate what I later found out was co-infections and Lyme. So yeah, that's how it started for me. So I don't remember seeing a tick, but because I was at a cottage and I had a vague conception of what, that Lyme was a danger, it was the first thing. But I didn't know enough to challenge the doctors when they told me that it couldn't be Lyme disease
Yeah.
because it wasn't a bullseye.
Yeah. And it sounds like you saw not just one, but multiple people that are essentially saying other things, that it's not Lyme disease. So, yeah, it makes sense that it would be. How would you challenge them? Yeah.
And every doctor I asked, could this be Lyme disease? It was one of the possible ideas that I had that it could be. But I've never experienced anything like this in my life. But yeah, I trusted the doctors when they said no
Yeah.
and thought that, the antibiotics that I was given was enough to get rid of those initial weird symptoms and just thought nothing of that. So I thought That was it.
Yeah, that's something that I still, when people reach out to me, struggle with is how to guide them when they're interacting in the healthcare setting. Exactly what you said. Like I tell them, I say, just a heads up, you need to be ready to advocate. They're going to be told you're wrong. And then you have to be able to say actually, and then in the role of a teacher. And so it's very tricky, and lots of people experience similar where they don't feel comfortable sort of standing up to people that, that are in power in that situation, because they decide, what's prescribed, what is this, what is that. So after you go through all these places, then how did you eventually come to getting connected? Hey, I might have Lyme disease. And how long of a time frame would you say from when the initial symptoms started till when you got that proper, like, hey, this is Lyme disease and such?
So it took about, I was starting to experience some really vague type of symptoms, probably say vague and indistinct. It wasn't until I would say 8 months later, just as the pandemic was starting, literally a week before the pandemic started, just the tail end of February, where I had systemic, very strange symptoms. And for the first time in my life, called 911 for myself.
Oh,
Never had
wow.
called 911 for myself. I just had the strangest experience and symptoms that I've never experienced before. So, yeah, when the systemic symptoms started, I didn't clue in that what had happened to me at the cottage was the cause. It didn't help that the pandemic was starting. So, of course, everybody was, in a state of anxiety. So, I mean, when you experience these type of symptoms and you don't have And and every person who has Lyme knows that the symptoms are insane. They're literally insane. And it just got worse and worse. It kind of snowballed to where very shortly, within a month, I would be waking up and have, I didn't know what fresh water would be waiting for me. I would just have the strangest symptoms that would always change and were incomprehensible and frightening and scary. And so I didn't have a clue at that time what was going on. The whole world was under siege. I was going to emergency and, they would screen me for COVID, of course, but nobody really had a clue what was going on. And maybe we'll get into that later, but usually when you present these symptoms, one of the first things when a doctor doesn't know is to say that, well, it's somatic. And so I had to deal with that. So it took several months. It wasn't until, funnily enough, I would say I was about a couple of months into having these crazy symptoms that I was sitting and watching a documentary. And it was a documentary on the life of Kathleen Hanna. She's a punk singer from, I don't know if you remember, Riot Girl. Riot.
Not familiar, no, but carry on.
Yeah, so it was a documentary in her life, and it got to the part where she talked about her illness, and she got Lyme disease.
Oh, okay.
And so she was talking about her symptoms, and then she was talking about her symptoms. I looked at the person I was sitting beside on the couch, and I was like, oh my God, do I have Lyme disease? So that was a clue. And then also when I was in and out of merge and experiencing all of these crazy things, one of the friends that I was with at the cottage actually kind of refreshed my memories. Like, didn't you have these weird symptoms, last year when we were at that cottage? And a light went off in my head, and I'm like, so it was a bunch of little things. And then also it was one of the things, because it was one of the first things I'd asked when I had the initial symptoms. So among the things that I was begging testing for, I did beg to have Lyme testing done, among other things. But there were a lot of scary diagnosis that was being bandied about before I came to confirm that diagnosis, everything from MS to Guillain-Barré syndrome to it's in your head and you're crazy.
Yes.
To so yeah, everybody's favorite.
Yeah, oh, that's my favorite for sure. Yeah, I love that one.
It's in your head and you're crazy, and it's got a fancy name for, I forget, it was like something somatiform.
Yeah, I can say I was in the emergency situation. I received an actual pamphlet on exactly what you're saying for somatic. Like, hey, if you need to learn how to sort of understand that these are sort of psychological symptoms. You can go to BC and do that. I was like, oh, okay. But yeah, so kind of going off what you're saying, that is everybody's favorite. That's sarcasm for the listeners. The favorite part of it is when gaslighting. So yeah, I'll put that word out there.
We need the gaslighting.
For those that can't see, Alex and I are both, we're just like,
We're just
oh, like we're like, oh, okay, yeah, me, that's too familiar. That is unfortunately too familiar. So yeah, so I won't take you too off track there, but you're saying you got all these scary diagnoses, and then you have this aha moment where someone is like pinpointing to you at the cottage, actually, similar symptoms. And then so eventually you had to plead for some Lyme disease and probably some co-infection testing. Kind of walk us through leading up to that point. Like, how did you find this help? Because a lot of people listening are still in that phase of, I don't know what direction to go. Like, who's going to be my treatment person? What background is that person even? Like, what are they? So yeah, can you kind of tell us a bit of your journey navigating that?
It was a crazy journey and it was very windy. I was so desperate. When you're that sick and when you have all of these incomprehensible things, and it literally, it was almost like it happened overnight, even though it didn't, it was a buildup. But when you have systemic symptoms, it really gets out of control very quickly. You have no conception. You're scared. You don't know where the bottom on these symptoms are. They're worsening. Nobody can give you any sort of conception of what's happening to you. So I really reached out. So I had a lot of unfortunate encounters with doctors. I think the fact that I experienced this while the pandemic was starting didn't help because everything shut down in terms of resources, even more so. And I think everybody was in a state of anxiety. So that doesn't help. And it's just another layer to deal with when you're, dealing with immune issues. But initially, so I'll give you one story. The world had shut down and I was dealing with all of these crazy symptoms, and everybody and their dog was getting therapy because of the pandemic. So, my regular counselor didn't have time. So there wasn't any mental health supports while I was going through this. And so I actually answered an ad. There was here in Ottawa, it's totally escaping my mind. It'll come later, but
Yeah,
there's
feel
an
free to come back to it if it pops in there.
Yeah, it's the it's a Ottawa institution that deals with mental health, and they were offering free counseling to anybody, open to the public, I guess, because of the pandemic.
That
And
was my
so,
next question, Alex. So you already answered it. Is it free? And so yes, carry on.
it was
It is
supposed to be,
free.
yeah, that was supposed to be free.
Yeah.
It wasn't a good choice though. So let me explain. So so I reached out and was like, okay, free counseling. I need help because I'm going through this crazy time, and a little bit of mental support would be great because I'm also isolated. I'm living alone at that time. The world is shut down. I have no access to really anything. And so I signed up, talked to a nurse, and my understanding is that there would be some intake with a doctor. That was my understanding. That was part of the intake process to see if I would be eligible for these free mental health supports, free counseling. And I had a 1 hour session with a doctor that I'd never met in my life. It was a Zoom session. And my understanding, this was part of the intake process. At that time, I didn't have Lyme on my radar, but I was experiencing these crazy symptoms. I was starting to, visit the emergency room and explained what I was experiencing in terms of my symptoms and some of the hardships that I was going through at that time. And he told me, well, it sounds like you might have fibromyalgia, this type of thing, and this drug and might be useful and this sort of stuff and anxiety and all this sort of stuff. And my mom has fibromyalgia. She's been diagnosed with it. I know the drug that he mentioned because she was on it. And I knew the dangers of that drug. And I knew myself it wasn't fibromyalgia because I've seen that up close with my mother. She was diagnosed in the 90s. So, but I thought, whatever. It's just, I'm not here for this. I'm here just to have this intake so I can get some free, counseling. So I waited for that time and, I followed up with them maybe once or twice to say, where's the intake process at? Will I have access to these free mental health supports? And during this time, I'm starting to go in and out of emergency, dealing with these crazy symptoms. And my experiences at emergency, when they can't figure out what's going on, they would do some testing, and the labs that they did would show normal. So they, would send me to the psych ward a couple of times to talk to the nurse there, because I couldn't think of what it might be. So somatic. And I remember the frustration I had at that time. And I would literally cry and break down because there's a pandemic going on. And I don't also feel safe at the hospital. And there's limited resources. But I'm also dealing with these very, very scary symptoms. I was having blackout seizures, this type of stuff. I noticed when I would go to visit Emerge that the doctors would be saying something to me. And I would sometimes go to a different emergency room. So, there's a few hospitals here, and I would remark, or I'd see a different doctor, and I'd remark to my partner at the time, "It's really strange. I'm seeing these different doctors, but it's almost like they're using very similar language. Very similar. It's almost like they're reading a script," is what I said to him. It's very odd. And I was feeling very frustrated at that time, feeling very dismissed. I was begging for testing to be done, whether it's some viral testing or Lyme testing. I wanted to get to the bottom of what was happening to me, to get some answers, trying to figure out what was happening, but I would be dismissed. And it wasn't until I went to an emergency room, and the doctor there, she'd mentioned to me offhand, she said, "Well, you might be having trouble because this doctor, there's this note on your chart, and this doctor thinks it's somatic."
Wow,
And
okay.
I said, "What note?"
Oh
So I got access to this note, and lo and
no.
behold, it's this psychiatric doctor who interviewed me for this free intake support, and he wrote a report stating that he thought that my symptoms were largely somatic and anxiety, and that he basically made a recommendation to not do testing on me because that would just increase the anxiety. And when I looked at that report, I realized, oh my God, this is what these other doctors were reading off of.
It
And
doesn't
so,
really give you a chance when you have a note that says it on your file. Like, you're going against the grain no matter what you say, no matter how you're presenting. If you have that note on your file, you're swimming upstream. Sometimes I like to try to think of these random examples. I see these fish. A bear comes in with its claws, and just even though you're swimming upstream, I'm swatting in the screen right now. The bear's like hitting you at the same time or eating you. That's the graphic that you just painted for me there. You're battling.
I'm battling and not even aware, like the lack of transparency. I was angry. And I'll try not to swear on this podcast, but I was just so upset. First of all, it was just very, the transparency, that was not something that he told me in our consultation when I was talking to him that he thought these things. I mean, he just said anxiety in a kind of very vague way because of the pandemic. But it was, he told me he thought it was fibromyalgia. And here he is in a report saying, like, a literal, no, it's, somatic. So that was something that he didn't disclose to me, that his thoughts of that on, as the patient. The fact that there was a chart, even that there was a chart created, like I wasn't, I was signing up for mental health supports, and that was my understanding this was an intake. Not that there would actually be a chart. Like, I didn't go to this doctor to diagnose me for for what I was dealing with. I was going for an intake process to get free mental health supports. And here I have this chart that I didn't know was, or this report that I didn't know was created, and it's on my chart every time I go to an emergency room or go to a hospital. And it's literally, I feel like the doctors who have very little understanding of Lyme can't think of it. Oh, there's this report that says, well, it's pro and it, again, I've never met this guy in my life. 1 hour session just telling what was happening, and he didn't even have access to, I don't think, or bother to even look at my medical chart to see the symptoms I had just, 6 months prior, that I had been at the cottage and all of these things. So to me, this is just wildly incompetent. It's just, the word is escaping me now, but there's a word, and just a lack of justice. Like, it's just, it's not, yeah, I was just absolutely shocked, and actually tried to make a formal complaint. But at that time, I was so weak, crawling on the floor. I'm still looking for answers. I had a meeting that was arranged, and nobody told me about it until the last minute. So I'm here in this Zoom session or, a phone session with this doctor, asking him to take this off of my chart because this is, at that time, I think I had also just started to get the Lyme diagnosis and had the testing that confirmed it. So I wanted that off of my chart. And he disagreed, and he had another doctor there listening. And I'm here by myself without no advocate, without an advocate, and just crawling on the floor trying to battle this, this injustice. And so I realized then, it was basically a Dear John letter in a meeting. And I realized I can't focus my energy at this point on this because it's not going to go anywhere. They're more powerful than I am. And also I'm really sick and I need to focus on getting better. So I just dropped it. But that was one example. There are other examples of, and I'm sure most of, the people that
I feel like if someone made a podcast, probably just those experiences in health and healthcare, you could have the 3 hours just about that, probably, is my guess for a lot of people. And as you said, it's not just because you have what you're saying is you have an actual misdiagnosis on your file, and it's heavily, heavily stigmatizing your care going forward, but it's not accurate in the first place. So you have multiple things going on. You have an error, you have a misdiagnosis, and stigma now with the rest of the people that you see going forward. And in the community, unfortunately, we hear that. And I'll jump back a little bit to something you said. You were talking about your results coming back normal. And I kind of want to just sit in that topic for a little bit here, because me myself have had regular tests come back normal too. And it's really hard when you're being gaslit at the same time because the results are coming back normal. So it's really hard to not start to question yourself. Did the gaslighting start to have any effects on you?
I don't think the gas, you, I don't think you cannot be affected by the gaslighting. So definitely at the beginning, I mean, I knew that what I was experiencing was not normal. I knew that what I was experiencing was not anxiety. I knew my brain had not created, I've had an experience of in my early, like in my teens of what a panic attack was. So I knew what that was. And I knew that this wasn't that. I knew that this was something else, but I didn't know what it was. And so I had so much frustration with going in and out trying to get answers that when a doctor presented, and this is another doctor, I went to see an infectious disease doctor who, quote unquote, told me to do yoga. And, at that time I was having like really difficulties with breathing. He told me to, quote unquote, just stop.
Okay.
That was his.
Just stop, stop. Okay, so this is again the sarcastic side of me. Does that mean stop breathing or does that mean stop doing yoga?
Oh,
Or
no. I think it was with regards to having difficulty breathing. It was just like, just stop having difficulty breathing.
okay. Because I was like, that'd be something else. Like, because you do, like, just, I was like, stop yoga, stop breathing, stop having difficulty with breathing, stop talking, stop, the list goes on. So.
It goes on, it goes on. And I was just so confounded by what? That's your medical advice is when I have a symptom, quote unquote, just stop. So
Okay.
And this is, a guy near the end of his career, an older doctor. And we've had, I saw him about 3 times. We had very interesting, wacky conversations where at that point it was becoming more and more clear to me it was dealing with Lyme. And we actually had a conversation where he said to me, chronic Lyme does not exist. It does not exist. And this is an infectious disease doctor. So Lyme disease exists, but chronic Lyme doesn't exist. And I asked him, well, what happens to those people who don't get diagnosed, who don't get treated in the acute phase? Then what happens then? And what ensued was a long conversation that made absolutely no freaking sense. I actually have that. I've kept that conversation because it was just so nutty. But this is what you're dealing with when you're looking for answers. And I forget the original question. What was the original question that we were talking about? I think it
I'm
was.
If I'm being honest, and for the listeners to hear this too, I don't really quite remember either because I'm just so focused on what you're saying right now. Oh, it was about the labs coming back normal. And this is
Yes.
something I will just tell for the listeners. This is something I've told Alex, and I've developed some values for this podcast. When my brain goes blank, or when anybody else's does, we want to show that this is still some of the things that people, maybe not 100% remission on all aspects of Lyme and co-infections. These are some of the things that we're left with. So Alex and I are going to normalize that, and in that both of us had a bit of a blank there. And so I want you guys to know that if it happens, you don't have to be embarrassed about it. This is the best that we can do, right? So I knew that my brain would go blank at some point today too. I knew it because it has before. So the good news is it didn't go fully blank, like where it went radio silent for the listeners, right? So let's I feel clap. I'm doing a clap at the screen.
Clap for that. You were able to bring
Yeah.
it back. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. When you have the labs that come back normal, it's so the gaslighting, did it get to me? When that doctor charged and he said, you know, it, and again, he was reading the other guy's report, but you know, he said, it's, I think it's somatoform. There's a formal diagnosis for it, which is
Yes.
like somatic. It, and I said, at that point, I was so frustrated. I said, okay, you think the somatic, then what's the treatment? Treat me. You want to send me to psychiatric? Send me to psychiatric. At least I'll get treatment. At least I'll be safe. It was COVID at that time. So I was like, okay, if that's your diagnosis, what's the treatment? And when I asked him what the treatment is, he couldn't give me an answer. And I went to see him again, and he still didn't have an answer when I saw him the next time. There is no treatment for somatoform. You know, it is just such a unwieldy kind of diagnosis that makes literally no sense if you read it. And in terms of the treatment, it's not clear at all. So if you're going to diagnose somebody with, you know, saying it's somatic, well, they don't even have a treatment for that except to maybe go home, here, take some Ativan, which I was told by another doctor, told by my GP, was basically just accept that you have a chronic illness, here's some Ativan. And, you know, at that time I was like, this makes no sense. I was physically healthy 2 months ago, and now I have a walker and I'm crawling on the floor and I need almost 24/7 personal support care. And you're telling me just to go home and accept that I have a chronic illness, but nobody can tell me what this is, but it's probably anxiety and somatic, but you have no treatment for that. Like, it was just so infuriating. Now,
You'd
I
think
knew.
you'd think that if you're making the diagnosis, you'd know a little bit about the treatment. And it sounds like in that case, he didn't. Like, I have seen some people do some sorts of psychotherapy for it, but the fact that the person that is confident in their diagnosis, they're stamping that down for you. So going forward from there, at this point, did they decide that you may have said it that you don't meet criteria for free therapy, or are you still in that process at this point here of trying to decide if you will be able to get free therapy?
Well, at that time we didn't, so I had to rely on the I had to rely on not provincial, because I did do the provincial labs for Lyme, and at that point it came back negative. We all know that that can happen and why that can happen. So, like many people, I had to get ARM testing or other lab testing to confirm that. So once you have that, that's hard to see, I guess, within the OHIP covered, you know, provincial covered healthcare. Do they recognize those tests? So if they don't recognize those tests, how can you get access to treatment, right? So I was literally first out of the provincial paid medical treatment. So I, like most Lyme patients, had to pay for my own treatments. I had to pay for my own testing. I had to research all of my testing. I had to reach out to figure out what to do, how to navigate. You're at a time when you're at your sickest, forced to figure this all out on your own.
And
That was the reality.
Alex, so now you're also touching on another subject that I'd like to. I was thinking about it before the podcast. I was like, do we need to tease through it. And then my background of, past work, I was like, we need to dissect this a little bit for the listeners. What I hear you saying in here, and you could correct me, I don't mind on here, I'm not offended by that. What I hear you saying is when you're struggling with Lyme disease and co-infections, and as you said, so sometimes you're using a walker or on the floor, and it sounds like you're having neurological issues at this point as well. You're being thrown into the role of researcher. I'll do this. We'll make a little true or false. Are you expected to be a researcher when your brain is not functioning optimally? Thumbs up.
Absolutely. Yes,
Okay.
absolutely.
Yeah, I'll describe the screen. I got two thumbs up there. Are you, in a sense, expected to be your own medical doctor of sorts?
In some degrees, yes. There's so many gaps, and the different professions do not like to talk to each other, right? They have their own scope. And when you're sick, when you're dealing with a chronic complex illness, it affects practically every body system, right? And you're forced to not only, I mean, we know that the paid medical system is very segmented and siloed in terms of, you go to this doctor for this system, you go to this doctor for this system. It's very hard to find somebody that has a holistic, knowledgeable view of chronic illness and complex illness. So you're seeing very different types of different people looking at a very narrow lens of the human body and of illness. So there's that. And then you're also dealing with the paid and the unpaid, the private healthcare system in this country. And if you're a Lyme patient, you're forced into the private care system, if you're lucky enough to be able to afford some of that. And I mean, just to even navigate between, say, a naturopath and your GP medical doctor, like, forget about it. Those people don't talk to each other. They don't have any respect for each other in terms of. So, as the patient, you're forced to kind of navigate these very complex relationships with your own GP. I mean, I can't tell you how many times my GP wanted to divorce me initially because somebody with chronic illness, you take a lot of resources. And if they don't know what's wrong with you, then, so there's that. So you're walking on eggshells because you are dependent. They are the gatekeepers of our healthcare system. So it's very hard to say what you want to say at times and to stand up for yourself because you have to be nice and be diplomatic because you are in a vulnerable position and they have power that you don't have, which is access to care. And so you're navigating these very complex systems and you're navigating the relationships between this, trying to figure out how they fit together. And you're left to do that by yourself. And then you're left to be your own advocate.
That was my third finger, which I didn't put up in the screen yet. There you go again, answering my questions. Yes, that's my next one, is that. So yes, also you're expected to advocate for yourself when you're in, most people, when they come to something like emergency or a hospital setting, they're struggling. They're not at their best. It sounds like you're expected to be able to advocate for yourself, and I'll add four is educator. At the same time, there's a large gap. And while you're in that vulnerable state, you're expected to be an educator for the people around you to be able to help you because they may not know, they may choose not to know. And so that's four. I don't have the rest of the fingers planned out yet that I'll put up in the screen. But yes, so that's exactly what I wanted to highlight, that we have vulnerable patients having to step up into these massive roles that people on their best of days struggle with. Like, so if there's a 100% healthy person, let's take myself for example. If I'm expected to go to anywhere, a system where I'm less number of me than them, I'm sort of a minority. I'm stigmatized. My brain is not functioning optimally. But hey, fight for yourself, right? We're all resilient, and I guarantee probably you did fight for yourself to your best of your ability, but your ability is not what it would normally be, especially with all those things going on. So thank you for putting my next finger. Any other fingers before we get off this left hand here?
I mean, yeah, there's so many different roles. I mean, so if as a sick person or somebody who's dealing with this, your roles within your family with your partner changes, trying to explain that to family members. So you're not only dealing with the medical system, oftentimes you're also dealing at least with some, if not all, of your family members or the people that are closest to you might not understand what you're dealing with. It's kind of anything that's largely invisible and people don't have a frame for it. And, to be honest, unless
So,
I see.
Alex, sorry to interrupt you there. It's just there's something really important there that you're saying. So, with the family and the other relationships in there, and so a lot of those people go off their old school belief that medical systems, they are the final answer. How do you go about navigating, or how did you with those people in your life?
How did I do that? So I tried to arrange for counseling with my partner at the time, which was contraindicated actually against my treatment, but the toxicity and the dynamic was just also affecting my health. So it helps perhaps if you have access to counseling. It's very hard to find counseling and mental health supports for somebody that understands what Lyme is and just chronic illness. So you might have a counselor that can actually cause more harm than good if they don't really understand what you're dealing with.
Certain types of therapy are suggested to go very slow for the fact that you can have symptoms after and stuff like that.
Well, a lot of what we're forced to do when we have Lyme is contraindicated to healing. Ideally, you want to be able to focus on getting better, but you're forced into this role of advocating for yourself or researching. Like you're doing all of these things that are just wiping you out in terms of your energy, your emotions, your finances, just every, like you're just literally bleeding these resources and trying to get answers and trying to get treatment and access to treatment. And that can put your recovery in a tailspin because you're devoting so much energy to get access and to not be dismissed that you don't have time for recovery. And so that can be in the system, it can be in your relationships. Like you said, there's certain brain retraining programs where you're not supposed to do counseling or to do really any heavy lifting when it comes to emotional stuff because you're also already in fight or flight. But if you're navigating difficult relationships, your relationships are thrown into a tailspin. You're walking a very, very fine line as to how do you do this,
Yeah,
And I
how
don't.
and how, my question is, how would somebody, like, it still amazes me that, the fact that we're still here and we're healing. Like, how, if I was in previous experiences in work, I would look, I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, how are you doing this? Like, it is a form of resiliency that is no other. And Alex, so one thing I would like us to do is conceptualize, because there's a lot of people with brain issues, and there's a lot of stuff to unpack here. I want to put words for those people, and you and I are going to do that on the spot here, because when better to think of the ideas but on the spot, right? That's your
Always fun when
that's everyone's
you.
favorite thing in the world. But so I want people listening to hear this, and I want them to hear it loud and clear. These illnesses and diagnosis are not easy. If you had to ask me, I would use the words horrific, hellish, torture, like getting beaten down and expected to thrive and get back up every single day without, the care and such that is needed. So that's me. I don't expect everybody's to be that dark. But for me, that's these health issues. It's so long. It's an endurance battle. And if you're an impatient person, you might run into some struggles. So I want to put into words for the people that are sitting here, they're saying, hey, relatives, grandma, grandpa, friends, romantic people, you need to hear this, and I need you to hear what these illnesses are like, because if somebody knows someone that feels like they're still undermining it or undervaluing the difficulty of the experience, hear it now and hear it from both of us. Both of us from different backgrounds. I'm not in a professional background right now, but I will tell you, these battles are severe for people. They are battles that other people would have for different diagnosis in the hospital. They would have six people on their medical team working on them. They would have home care. They would have someone doing meals. They would have someone doing help for neurological things. Anything else, Alex, that you want to shout out there to people of people in their circle of Lyme disease. They're telling you how hard it's been for us. Anything that you would like to add to that? That was a rant there.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, somebody who's going through Lyme disease is already experiencing a severe amount of gaslighting when they're dealing with systems, right? To come home and to deal with family members, it is also a form of gaslighting. So there is no safe space then, you know? So it's not like you can go lick your wounds and there's a safe space. Now, some people might have that. They might have family members that or supportive people in their life that they do have a little bit of a safe space, but for a lot of people, they don't have that. There's an assumption that people have that even if they have family members, that they have that support. And the reality is that this is very isolating because there is a lot of misunderstanding around it. It's a form of gaslighting, and you know, your description is accurate. It was a year ago that I saw a quote somewhere. It had nothing to do with Lyme disease, but it was about how getting access to healthcare treatment, access to safe housing, this sort of stuff. To not be able to have access like that is, it's a form of violence. And that word was really important to me to see and understand that, you know, it is a form of violence that you're experiencing when you're constantly in this vulnerable state trying to get answers and you are being gaslit. It is a form of abuse. And so that somebody feels battered going through this. I mean, the symptoms enough are just terrifying in and of themselves. But it's the experiences around. Even I can say for myself, I've made enough recovery. You know, I'm back at work. I can bike for 2 hours a day. It's day and night from where I was, you know, four years ago. But what stays with me, you know, the symptoms I can feel like I can heal from, right? They were horrific. But it's the interactions that happened around that, the barrier to access to treatment, of being dismissed, of dealing with the injustice of the treatment of those around you and those in the system. That's the trauma, the type of trauma that I think is the hardest to get over. And that's just my personal experience. And it is a form of trauma. It is a form of abuse. And so if you're a family member that wants to, I don't know what, I don't know. I feel like there are some people, no matter what you say, that's just, there are some people that don't seem, they seem to struggle with empathy. So I don't know that anything I say will make a difference. But if you're a family member, you know, that does have some empathy, just understand that you might not understand what your loved one is going through, but understand that somebody might be trying to explain to you and they're describing, I don't know, a sunset, or just realize that what you're getting from them is probably one tenth of what they're actually experiencing.
Exactly.
The ability to actually explain what you're going through, like it's, you think it's worse or you think it's bad, it's probably 10 times as bad as what they're telling you. Keep that in mind, and keep in mind that it is a battle for somebody to go through this and to deal with the systems. If you can be a support, to be an advocate. When I look back on the types of help that I found was the most, the help that I was so grateful for actually came sometimes from strangers even. Like it was, you know, I had a naturopath that called the hospital and actually talked to the doctors and said, look, I know this person for, I've been treating her for 12 years. She's not crazy. Just a phone call like that. Or I had another friend that showed up at the hospital with me and he wanted to give one of the doctors a talking to because he just thought this was not good. This was very unfair. And he wanted to yell at a doctor and he sat outside with me.
For the record, we are not condoning
Oh no, we're not
anything.
condoning
This is personal experience. Yes,
that.
Carrie, go ahead, Alex. Sorry to interrupt.
But the simple things that if you're a family member or friend, somebody's going through this, it's a great amount of gaslighting. So even just the little things like that is an antidote to ungaslighting, right? Is to say, I know this person, you know, they're a good person, they're telling the truth, or I'm gonna sit outside with you, you know, and be with you while you're going through this. Like there's just like the things that really helped me were very simple caring things. They weren't even huge things. I mean, probably from their viewpoint, but they were to me. So keep that in mind when you're providing support. It's not even the big, huge things. It's just helping that person go through what is a terrifying experience.
Right. Yeah. So even there, you're helping provide some tips. Unless you have it, you'll never fully understand it. And so we can't expect the person to fully understand living the experience, but we can expect them to still be supportive in whatever way works for that person and believing them. So for everybody out there listening, Alex went through a lengthy period of time where she was kind of navigating the system and sort of felt eventually, the system is no longer really helpful for her and not getting the help that she needs, getting gaslit. And so eventually you're pushing for diagnosis and testing. I think you mentioned Armin Labs. That's a lab out of Germany. I'm pretty sure I did mine through them as well. Who did you land on for your practitioners? Because that's a common question I get is, hey, what type of practitioner treated you? Is it ND, naturopath? Is it MD? Is it a mix? So tell us a little bit about that so people can get an idea what practitioners helped you heal to where you're at today.
Yeah, it's definitely a mix. So I was on a waiting list to see an LMND, and that took a few months to get there. And I was just suffering at that time. So I was able to get access to an LMND before that while I was waiting. And then even when I was with the LMD, continue to do some naturopath sessions because it's just quicker access. I think, usually when you see an MD, that's Lyme literate. You're usually paying for it out of pocket, and they're very busy. So you've got probably like at least 3 months at the minimum between sessions. And everybody knows when you're dealing with this, time just collapses. Time just goes at a snail's pace, and you are literally living second to second, minute to minute. Your world kind of condenses and gets small, and you're just literally surviving to get to the next minute. So surviving between doctor's visits is a big challenge. And so, yeah, I did supplement that with LND. I don't know if you can hear the thunder out here. It's quite
I
rainy.
got a little connection, but we'll probably just care. We'll carry on with it because, yeah, I heard you say it was LLMD and ND and a little bit of both there. And for people listening, LMD means Lyme Literate Medical Doctor. So that is the degree of a medical doctor combined with additional training, where they can then call themselves LLMDs. And ND is a naturopathic doctor. So that's your naturopath that you, when you Google like naturopath, that's that person as well. So it sounds like you did a mix of both. Both those practitioners sort of helped you different points of time.
Yeah, I've seen more than one practitioner. Like I've seen a couple of MDs, and I'd say a handful of NDs. And part of that was access as I navigated this, trying to find people and availability. And also part of it was also realizing that certain practitioners seem to have more of a specialization or a focus on particular aspects. So there might be one practitioner that was really good and really understood mold, for example, or detoxing from environmental toxicities, whereas another might be more focused on actually treating the co-infections and infections. So yeah, it was a very windy road in terms of finding the right people, finding the right fit too, right? That's really, really important when you're going through this, is to find the people where you feel heard. Because you literally can find somebody that is, Lyme literate, that it's not a fit for some reason. So,
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And what you say, it's about the best fit for you. Yeah. And I've heard people in the community describe it because I was looking for the longest time for a LLMD, so Lyme Literate Medical Doctor, but I needed them to have specialties in all the, there's like a very common list of things that slow or prevent Lyme healing. You mentioned mold, that's one of them. I also needed them to be a specialist in SIRS treatment too, because I was heavy down the SIRS path of chronic inflammatory response syndrome. I also needed them to be a specialist in mast cell activation syndrome, multiple chemical sensitivity. So I needed somebody that was not just Lyme disease. I needed all the like a panel of co-infections experience, the treatment, but I also needed for me a functional medicine medical doctor to sort of supplement the root causes of all of it. So people told me in the support, like, the Facebook groups, they're like, hey, like, I hear what you're saying. You might be looking for a unicorn. You might consider splitting and then staggering your appointments between the MD and the naturopath MD. So I eventually wound up doing that, and that's my mix for me that's working. And as you say, it's what works for that person. And it depends how far along in the illness they are, how severe. I was looking for a unicorn. I'm not saying they don't exist. There's probably a couple out there. They're like, hey, I'm an LLMD and I know all of what you just said. And yes, I just didn't find you when I was searching. So
Yeah, if
I know
anybody finds
there's
that unicorn, let us know, because that would be, yeah, that person's gonna be very, very busy. But yeah,
Oh,
exactly what
yeah.
you said, like you have different phases of your treatments and healing, and because when you're dealing with something like this, it's rarely, it comes with other things, right? Your body's, it's the boiling pot thesis of illness. It's not just a clear A equals B vector. It's usually a bunch of things by the time you become that sick. And somebody that can kind of address all of those things is, I mean, very difficult to find. It's a lot of information to have. And so I think the reality is that you do go searching for things. And I think in my case, because a lot of my symptoms are remain to be nervous system and brain related, that I actually had to look for certain even adjunct support. So for example, I had a lot of and still have visual issues. So I had to search for a visual therapist as well as part of my treatment. So yeah, you can't go to necessarily one practitioner that knows everything. It's very rare for them. And that's the reality of even being in the paid medical system and outside of the paid medical system. The thing that sucks is if you're paying for it, you're paying for it. So,
Yes,
those Lyme
exactly.
numbers, I think there's an average that you're at least paying over 100K for your treatment. And that is absolutely true. And that's the crime. That's the crime here in our country.
It's so expensive. It's painfully expensive. And that's a topic that hits me. Like, it's I don't think people quite understand that some people during their treatments, they are, I'll say use myself because it might be helpful for people to hear. Like, I didn't pay for a haircut for probably 2.5 years because I knew that would take away money for my medicines, and those are more important. This is like a funny story. About 3 months ago, because I knew this podcast stuff was coming up, I paid for someone to come into my house, and it was really expensive. I was like really not happy about it, and I'm not kidding. It was the worst haircut. Like, I don't care about my hair, but there was like just such a struggle. I was like, I just want a little bit straight. Like, there's chunks sticking out here. And then she came back. She's like, what about now? I was like, there's chunks sticking out everywhere. So, but anyways, people will understand that that's not something I can afford still today, because I'm still off work, is haircuts. So I'm happy for those that are at a point where they can afford it. But there's many people out there, like the degree of poverty that these illnesses can put you in. Like, there's so many people that their dream is to have a safe spot to live that's not triggering their nervous system, therefore weakening their immune system further. Like, it's the levels of, and I hesitate to use the word devastation because people use that for natural disasters commonly, but it cripples all it can. And so again, I don't want to terrify people to say if you have these illnesses and you're still afloat, not to say it will get this bad, but for those that it does get that bad, like, it's very bad. And for you, Alex, how did you keep afloat with these financial? I know you said it was you're pushed into the out of pocket now. How did you make ends meet?
So I'm lucky enough that I had a job that I could have paid medical disability, and I realized how grateful I am and lucky to have that. That was less than my full salary, so that helped definitely. But even with that, because I spent way over, I'd say about 120K over 3 years for my treatments for, and that not only includes treatments, but for adjunct supports like personal support workers are expensive. I was literally so incapacitated that I needed help for somebody to make meals for me or to supervise me when I was having blackouts and all this sort of stuff. It got to the point where I was actually doing a tour of seniors' homes in the vicinity looking for a cheap way to have or what I thought was the more affordable way to have supervision and support, because that's how bad I was. But they are also expensive. So the assumption is that you have people or family members who will just be your caregiver. And that's not the reality for a lot of people, even with family members. So a lot of the treatments are expensive, the doctors, the naturopaths, and the adjunct supports. So I have significant medical debt right now. I am back at work, but I'm still trying to figure out how to, I'm still living hand, like basically like what's the term? Like foot to, no, not, no, I was gonna say foot to mouth. That doesn't sound right. Hand to foot, hand to foot, hand to mouth. Hand to mouth. Not foot to mouth. That sounds bad.
If you're that flexible, that is impressive. I lost that flexibility, so yeah.
that's another disease, foot mouth disease.
It is. Yeah. Are
But
you looking for the word where you're living paycheck to paycheck, or am
yes, that
I?
sounds better.
Okay.
That sounds
Okay.
better.
Yeah, paycheck to paycheck. And I think there's an even more like
Hand to
intense
mouth, I think, is
than
the
that.
term.
Some yeah, something along those lines. Yeah. So basically, yeah.
I'm still trying
Pay.
to figure it out, but at the time I struggled with how to make ends meet or how to pay for certain things. There were certain things I had to navigate to do that. So things, and I hope with, this podcast will share, people will get to share some of what they found helpful. Because when you're going through this, you don't have a clear path or protocol, and you're just, when you're that sick, and your brain is affected, your executive functioning, to be able to make these decisions while you're going through this is very hard. You're so sick, you'll try anything to get better, right? And that's literally what people do, is that you're just literally bleeding money trying to figure out what path to take. And in hindsight, there are things that you could, I feel that everybody has lessons learned in terms of what worked best for them, what strategies they might take now to kind of make a clear path for those that will follow. Because I know, probably as you have, like I've survived not by talking to doctors, really. It's to by talking to people, these communities like LIMO Canada, a few people that were a few steps ahead of me in their treatment. Those are the people that really helped me in trying to figure out a way through this, how to navigate, what to try. So, yeah, there's definitely things that I can think in hindsight, looking back, okay, maybe this would be a better way to use your limited resources. But yeah, when you're going through it, it's just hard to be able to have that foresight and to have that strategy, because you really don't know what you're dealing with, right? I hope that changes for people, and that there'll be more tools for them. But yeah, there were just like little things. So testing, so people would want me to do testing. And so one thing I figured out was sometimes you can order testing directly from labs, and you can prevent markups that way. There's a lab somewhere in the States that they can actually order US labs for you, and you can prevent some markups that way. I'll have to remember the name of these organizations, but yeah, they're kind of like the bodies that regulate the testing for different, whether it's naturopath or medical, that you can kind of talk to see if you can get.
And it sounds like, and save a bit of cost on the actual testing without the clinic, like if you're ordering from the practitioner type of thing. So that's good to know for people.
And some of those labs will provide free kind of like one-on-one interpretation of that. So yeah, I did that to remember that being a thing I was trying. But yeah, I mean, there's just so many things looking back that, and I don't know if this is another session that, but tips about what to do or things that, I wish I could have had somebody kind of holding my hand to say, put your money here and not this so much, but
Right.
yeah,
And
I
it
just
sounds
don't have
it's
that.
and it sounds like so in terms of the finances tips in particular, some of them will kind of maybe loop around to near the end again, but in terms of finances, because you're in the province of Ontario, it sounds like you had some work-related payments coming, not the full wage, but similar. And then it sounds like I don't know if you did this at the time or you did it later on, you researched the lowest cost of the testing, so potentially saving on clinic costs and things like that. Anything else that comes to mind in
Yes.
the province of Ontario in
Sign up for
particular?
your when you do your taxes, apply for your disability credit. That's a
Okay.
letter from your doctor. You can get that done. Call, there's like a community access care. It might be called something different in your province. They coordinated care. Now, they weren't very helpful in my case. The algorithms for them suck in terms of they are only focused on, for a worst case scenario, there's only funding like if you're falling down every day, and like they have certain algorithms that trigger if you're eligible for certain supports, whether that's meal prep or having somebody, come out and check on you. These might be available in your province, and the algorithms might suit what you're dealing with, so it's worth a go to ask them. If they can't help, they can at least refer you to other resources that might be able to. In my case, they weren't really able to, so I still had to pay for out of pocket for that. Another thing is community programs. So initially, I was having the crazy neurological symptoms. I was having POTS like symptoms. I was crawling on the floor. And so at that time, they were piloting a community paramedic program. And I think it's for all of Ontario, but I might be wrong. So that was great. Instead of having to go to eMERGE, or if you're having certain issues with blacking out or vital signs or that sort of stuff, they actually have somebody that can come to visit you to do all of that sort of checking on things. So there might be something similar in your province that has like a community paramedic program. So yeah, it's really checking out to see what calling your community access care center to see is there anything in your province for anything that you might be able to get help with. Just even like simple things, I find these are gaps in adjunct supports, but like things like filling out a form when you've got brain fog and injury, like just doing the simplest of things is a chore and is it feels insurmountable. So even filling out a form to get access to certain
Yes.
care is just too much. And so I don't know if they have those supports in your province, but it's worth asking. One thing that I had to do because I couldn't keep affording the personal support workers is I hired a student. So I actually contacted the nursing, what do you call them? Practical care nursing schools. So if you contact the schools, they can let you know if they have any students that might be able to provide some care at a reasonable cost, more reasonable cost. So I did that, and I was able to find a student who was able to come in and help me with my meals. She helped me with taxes, like just like stuff like that. So that was something creative that I had to do.
That's an awesome idea. And going back to when I was in school, I chose a clinical with a family struggling with MS. And exactly that. You go in, you're doing your own, stuff for your school program, but you're jumping in and doing tasks at the same time. I did not even think of that ever until you just said it now. And so if those don't exist, it's good for people to hear that because people that are heavy into advocacy, that might be them reaching out to, for example, some registered or licensed practical nursing, like, hey, do your students want to do a clinical and help this list of patients? So but in the future, someone might want to take on that task for advocacy, making that connection available to people. That is such a good idea. Thumb up, I put it in the screen.
No, it's yeah, you're forced to be creative. And then what, there was another thing I did. I'm trying to remember. It just flew out of my mind. Oh, ABI supports, right? A way that I found a lot of when you're dealing with something like Lyme, words are important, right? And certain words seem to have a certain valency. And you have to be careful around using certain words when you're dealing with the medical system, but also just words in general to explain to other people what you're dealing with and to conceptualize what you're dealing with. And for me, it was brain injury. I definitely experienced brain injury as a result of this. I feel like a lot of the supports that I found that were the most supportive in my recovery, apart from the antibiotics and the supplements to address the infections, was actually the brain retraining. And I've done a lot of different things for that. And I actually reached out to ABI supports in my community to see, was there anything that was being offered that was free? As it turns out, there isn't. I mean, most of that, again, the algorithms for our community care are really focused on like really, really worst case scenarios, like, traumatic brain injury from like car accidents or strokes where you can't feed yourself and that sort of stuff. It's hard to get those brain supports if you're kind of in the middle of that, whether it's brain fog or not being able to read or these sort of things. But it's worth asking because there might be something in your province, but ABI support. So that's something I think is also worth asking about and talking to somebody because it really is. For me, it was a brain injury. Yeah, there's a little story about how that became clear to me.
Oh, if you feel free to share because I'm super interested in that because Lyme, the bacteria itself can cross up into the brain. And then if it's not that, chronic inflammatory response can have inflammation in the brain. We can get spots or masses on our MRIs in our brain. So when you say that you refer to it as a brain injury, that's putting words into people who are still struggling with their neurological or brain issues. Myself, I couldn't explain because my brain was so heavily affected. Like something is not right. But this helps with healthcare to be able to conceptualize what's going on when they hear words like that. Because when you hear brain injury as a practitioner, it should flag you that this person might need support with the paperwork. This person might struggle with the appointments. They might have to record it, and I might have to send them, might have to narrow it down. I might have to help them figure out what their tasks are going to be when they go home, or I might need to try to help them find someone to do that. So for the family and friends listening in, know that you have to communicate with the person. You can never just jump in and do something they don't want you to do. But offering to just say, hey, I don't get it, but what can I do to help you right now? That person still might neurologically be able to tell you what to do. So researching the financial things that Alex has just really nicely outlined, if it's at a standstill, start researching and hearing real stories. Hop onto these podcasts and listen to what it's like for people actually struggling through it. Because that in the times like where you don't know what to do, you're at a standstill, that will be helpful. But know that you're not the expert, the person with the illnesses is in what's going on with them. So check your ego and your I'm gonna tell you what to do at the door. That's probably not helpful. I'm putting my hand up on the side of the
No.
screen because I'm pushing it
Yeah.
away.
Let's push
That's
it away.
nine times out of 10, that's probably not helpful. Like, don't get me wrong. There are some people that are so progressed with their illnesses that they are not able to do neurologically, verbally, any of that stuff much. Maybe that person does need you to come help pick them up, help them, like help them, make them a bucket of water so they can wash themselves for the first time in 7 days. Like, I want to help you. Anything. Like, can I vacuum for you? Can I do the dishes for you? Can I cook you a meal? Can I have this? I have this $20 here. Like, I don't need it. Can I just leave it with you? Can I give it to you? Is that okay? Like, would you like this money? Like, those are things for me. I can't speak for everybody, so you always have to ask the person. And something I'm really excited about in this podcast is to better conceptualize for the people struggling to get those words still. And you just helped do that, Alex. So thank you.
Yeah, it definitely. So for me, I mean, I definitely was having all of the nervous system and brain symptoms along with everything. It wasn't until I went to a practitioner because I was having and still have visual issues. My brain and my visual issues are kind of the long-standing things that I'm still dealing with. And so I'm sure a lot of Lyme patients have gone to the hospital where they do those the testing to see your nerve conduction. And if it turns out normal, they basically say, well, there's physically, structurally nothing wrong with your nerves, so we can't figure out why. And it was the same thing with my eyes. I went to get an eye scan and assessment, and they're like, well, there's structurally nothing wrong with your eyes, so we can't understand. And so I had to research this. I forget how I came across it, but it was visual therapy. And so I found a visual therapist here in Ottawa, and she did her assessment, looked at my eyes. We did some testing, like she had me do all these sorts of tasks. And after looking at, explaining what I was experiencing and looking at my assessment, she says, this makes sense. And I can't tell you what a bomb it is. When you have gone through months or years of crap of people telling you that you don't make sense or that you're crazy, to have a practitioner say, and this is something for family members, for practitioners, it might not make sense to you, but just because it doesn't make sense to you doesn't mean it doesn't make sense. It just means
Yes.
you don't know, right? And oftentimes people can't check their egos and they have to make the other person wrong or crazy to protect themselves. But really, this is a matter of education. And when she said that makes sense, I just, everything in me just kind of relaxed. It was like, okay, this makes sense. And she said, your brain is behaving like your eye, your visual symptoms, it's your brain is behaving like a brain injured brain. And all the symptoms are what happens in brain injury. And she said, brain injury can happen. It can be a traumatic thing. You get in a car accident, you have a big blow to the head. It might be a stroke. It might be infections. It might be viral. It might be trauma. Like trauma can do that too, but also infections, you know. So what's, you know, somebody going through Lyme is dealing with infections, viral, trauma. Like you're dealing with all of these things. And when I reviewed all of the symptoms that I had, I was like, yes, I have had these crazy brain-related symptoms. And she said, so when she said that, it makes sense. You've got a brain-injured brain. And the eyes are an extension of the brain, right? So when she said that, I was like, oh, I have a brain injury. And that makes sense. And all the testing I've had done makes sense. And a lot of my treatments have focused on the brain and it makes sense. So what's happening is my brain was the sensory, the processing was all bungled up. So while structurally there might be things might seem okay, my brain is interpreting things differently because of what happened. And so it's something important to remember if you're going to get nerve conduction tests or get your nervous system checked out or get your eyes checked, and they structurally can't find something wrong. It doesn't mean that there isn't anything wrong with processing. And to be able to diagnose that, you have to go to the right people who actually focus on processing.
Right,
So
right.
it's finding the right people that actually understand that and look at that. So understand that if you're having a lot of these brain nervous system issues, it might be processing and because you have a brain injury. And
Yeah.
so once I knew that, and the brain is neuroplastic, you know, there are things that can be done. I mean, you have to treat the active infections. So, I think we're kind of getting a little bit of this with long COVID, and people are understanding, you know, post-viral syndrome that your brain, even past active infection, can kind of get stuck, right, in the certain patterning. So how to train your brain. And she said this with the visual therapy, which I couldn't do because I can't afford it, but there are exercises that you can do to retrain your brain to make those connections again to actually be able to process information. And so yeah, you know, it's a brain injury, and it's, I feel, and I've heard that in Canada, we're a little bit behind when it comes to brain injury and concussion and all these sorts of things and understanding the brain. There's so many things that can impact the brain, like environmental illness and toxicities and all these other things that we don't really think about when we think of brain injury, but
Right.
it
Yeah,
is the
exactly.
main factor of a lot of the symptoms, whether it's the pot related symptoms, whether it was like the paresthesias, the seizures, like, at least it can give, it's something that people seem to understand more than when if you just say Lyme, but you can say, well, I have a brain injury.
Yeah.
And you do. It's kind of like, you know, how chronic fatigue is often used as a kind of a accurate or a diagnosis that other doctors might understand as opposed to Lyme. It's the same thing with brain injury. It's one aspect of having Lyme that is something that some people can understand, and
Right.
it is useful in terms of looking at your treatments. Okay, well, a lot of my, and this is not for every person dealing with Lyme and co-infections, obviously, like everybody's got different things, but for a lot of people, it has affected their nervous system and their brains, so.
Definitely. And it sounds like, so where are you at with your brain and neurological symptoms compared to pre-illness. I like to use the 100% scale. Some people like to categorize stuff like this. Some people prefer not to. They find it stressful. To each their own. For here, it's helpful to kind of give us an idea how far you've come and what's helped you get there in terms of any programs or things like that.
Yeah, so I mean, physically, I would say night and day from where I was. So, as I mentioned, I've got energy to, I could bike 2 to 4 hours if I wanted to. I can, like, I'm,
That is amazing, by the way.
yeah. And I
That
couldn't
is,
do that at the beginning. I couldn't do
yeah.
that. I had like bludgeoning fatigue. And so that I think is a lot farther along. The visual and the brain stuff is still something that I struggle with, but I am making progress for sure. When I was in the worst of the infection, it affected my language center. So I had word recall issues. I would say the wrong word. I had dyslexia. I have ADHD brain now. I couldn't read, literally could not read for 2 years. And part of that was my brain not being able to interpret, as I found through the visual therapist, and also partly muscular, as my eyes weren't following, they weren't working together. So there's all these exercises you can do to help with that. But it did affect my brain. So funnily enough, a lot of the treatments that I found around, apart from the antibiotics and the supplements and the herbals and actually treating the infections and helping with detox and strengthening the body, a lot of the stuff that I found helpful is to do with the brain. So it's, very early on, something as simple as walking and biking. There's something about using the calf muscles, the soleus of the muscle that gets the blood pumping to your brain. And also the coordination, it when you have something like these infections, it disrupts your patterns. And so if you can do even little things that help to repattern things, because the brain is neuroplastic. So I had a physio that I was able to get for a couple of sessions that helped with balance and all that. And I found that was also very helpful, like just little exercises.
I've heard there's a strong connection to stability down at the feet and ankles, so like balance balls and things like that, in regards to the overall neurological connections that you described affects your eyes and your hearing and auditory and everything. So I have heard that also. And did you say that there in any particular program, like you know how there's all
Yes.
the brain, so we'll start there. Did you
Yeah.
use that brain retraining program?
I did. So very early on, I had a practitioner recommend the Dynamic Neural Retraining System,
So the
which is,
DNRS.
yeah. And I know a lot of people know about that. That is, I found, like, if there's money well spent in my estimation, that was one program that was. And I did it when I was doing the active treatment. It helped me to be able to better tolerate my treatments because there's a lot of inflammation going around in your brain and your body. The act of calming your vagus system and having a process for doing that was really helpful to be able to tolerate some of my treatments. Also putting my mind in a more positive state because you are stuck in fight or flight when you're dealing with all of these really shitty situations. So
Oh, yes.
being able to kind of retrain your brain to focus on the positive really does help with your recovery. So that was a really good program. And I still, to this day, will use the skills that I learned there if I'm dealing with something stressful that has nothing to do with Lyme. It's just a really good foundational thing to have. And then before I went back to work, I was looking for a program because I know that my executive functioning, my language, processing was an issue. Some memory. I actually did some training. I was looking for some testing that could help me understand my brain. And this is also a big gap. And I learned what not to do, where not to spend money, and what was useful. And funnily enough, I found neurofeedback was also useful. And some of the brain mapping through that. And there's an ADD center in Toronto that I did a few tests. That were very helpful in helping me pinpoint what was my brain actually struggling, what kind of tasks was my brain struggling with at this point. And then I found the BEARS program, which is out of BC. They were de just developed there, but they can do it remotely. So I did the program remotely. They have practitioners, I think, in every province, but it doesn't matter because you can do them
Oh, okay.
remotely. And the good thing about that is that I was able to find one place in Ontario where there's different types of practitioners that implement the program. So I was able to find a program that was actually implemented by somebody that would be covered under my private healthcare plan.
Right.
So one thing that was actually covered,
Yeah.
at least
Yay.
80%, which is, the one thing, which is good because I did that for several months, and it's a brain retraining program that deals with cognitive deficit, things like executive functioning, memory, this sort of stuff. So it has this kind of multi-pronged program where you're doing these cognitive tasks, you're being assisted either in a group or with one person, in person or remotely. And then it also focuses on, there's an exercise component, and then also like a kind of, I guess, a meditative component to it. So there's all these kind of science-backed things in the structure of this program to help your brain become more neuroplastic and kind of repatterning. So,
Okay, so the BEARS program, that's also super helpful for people to know. I hadn't heard that one until you mentioned it, and so that's new to me, but I'm really happy that you're putting that out there for the listeners too. And you said that it did wind up being covered, just to loop back a little bit,
yeah, I was
80%.
80% because of my plan covered physio. So I was able to find a physiotherapist that was able that, different places, they have different people that implement the program. It's a standardized program. So because you can do it remotely, if you can find somebody that might be covered under your plan, then that helps for sure. And yeah, I did that for several months, and they have their own testing, so you can kind of track your progress. And it definitely did make a dent in terms of, I did other testing as well through the ADD Center after I did that program, and found that my some of the things that I was struggling in had improved. So
Yeah, so that
yeah.
the also for you mentioning the ADD/ADHD type of resource centers, even though it's like it may not be your official diagnosis going into it, a lot of people struggle with those ADHD like symptoms. Basically, people are, they're at a point where like, okay, I basically can't do anything today. I can't focus to plan my day. That's a stress. My nervous system is activated. So for you to point out that it's good, like also for healthcare to hear that. There's these other diagnoses. They've got some really good stuff for those diagnoses, and they can apply to Lyme disease and co-infections and brain retraining also if you're struggling with those symptoms. So I've actually heard quite a few people in the community struggling with those ADHD symptoms. They can be very debilitating and prevent you from doing a lot of things. That's super helpful also. So I like that. I'm giving a shaking fist bump type of thing in the screen. That makes me happy. Is there anything else that was super helpful for the neurological aspects, or you've named quite a few? So it's entirely if there is something else or not.
So another thing I would say is, I think diet, there was a podcast that I listened to on the effects of mold and Lyme on the brain. And so I take Body Bio. There's a phosphatidylcholine. I don't know if
PC
you've heard.
oil, yeah.
PC oil, because apparently the brain to rebuild those fatty layers back, it takes about a couple of years. It's a long thing. And there's a nutritionist on Instagram that I came aware of through a practitioner, and her name is, I don't know if we're allowed to name names, but anyways, she's a practitioner in nutrition, and she trained in the Gershon method. So something to do with the brain. So brain related kind of like nutritional things that you can do. So the one thing that is a constant with me, like I'm not really treating infections at this point because I don't have the money to do it. But
Right, right.
the one thing that I am doing is the Body Bio phosphatidylcholine, trying to build up my brain back, build those for the mitochondria, just not even just the brain, it's just structurally. I mean, you can go check their site out. They have a lot of information on it. So that's something that I'm also doing for the brain. And then the
Is
next.
it just to dub, this is not important. This is where my random brain takes us. But the PC oil, I believe that is an oil that I nicknamed like slug, like schlug, because it's very thick. Is that the same one?
Yes, they have different ones. They have two. They have a balance oil, and they have a phosphatidylcholine, which is the slug. And
Slug. Okay. Yes. Yes. I just wanted to. I just for myself. That's a selfish comment. I just wanted to know if it was slug, and I was pretty sure it was. So yeah.
Slug.
Yeah, so it's not so
Thank
bad.
you.
It's I took it for quite a while too. You get used to it, and it can be very helpful, as you say.
I put it in a shake in the morning so I don't taste it. Like I put it in a blueberry. There's a shake that I make every morning that has, has all of these things that are supposed to be good for your brain, and I just kind of put it there. You don't taste it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's pretty foundational for me in terms of brain stuff.
All right. Well, yeah, I'm sure everybody is appreciative of all those suggestions. In terms of your overall healing, like neurological and brain aside, where would you say you're at if zero is no healing and 100% is at least the health of your pre-illness state?
I don't know how accurate this is, but I would guess maybe 70 to 75%
Okay.
from
Yeah.
what I was pre-illness. And I'm guessing that I could be wrong. It's hard sometimes when you're going through this because you're using your brain, which is struggling to actually assess.
Right.
But I would definitely have made a lot of progress. And I have that through tests that show that I have. And the fact that I'm at work, I work as a policy analyst. So I have to, think. And
Yes.
so that is something that, I'm able to at least do that rudimentarily, which even 3 years ago, I couldn't even freaking read, right?
Wow, yeah.
I couldn't read. It's like I had Teflon brain. I still kind of feel like it's not what it was pre-illness, and there are things that, continue to do. I think sauna also is a big thing, just generally, not just for your brain, but just for the lime and the detoxing. That was one thing that I continue to use to this day. I think the research on it is pretty clear in terms of the benefits. It was something that I could not tolerate in the beginning because I was so backed up with everything. But once I was able to tolerate it, I use that even to this day. I do at least 3 sessions a week, and it has been a godsend. Like the sauna is just, if you had to put some of your money towards something, that is something that really, really helped.
Yeah, and to add on to that, what I did is I waited till a Black Friday sale from a United States company. So I waited because there was a pretty significant discount then, and then I ordered mine then. And so something to start thinking about now for people is, hey, perhaps around, it was around the holiday time, Christmas time, New Year's that I saw it. So to start following those accounts, so you might catch some of those coupon codes and things.
Yeah. There's one, and again, I don't know if I can say, but there's a guy on Instagram in the States who treats Lyme and all that. And he recommends one. It's about $300, $400. So
Okay.
not cheap, but the fact that I've had it for 4 years now and it's still going strong, it's over the long term, probably the best money I ever spent.
Awesome. Yeah, I love my sauna also. So mine's infrared combined with, wait, let's see it. Hang on. Infrared, drawing a blank, but mine's the two things added. Not there's a couple other things you can add,
Red
so
light
it's
therapy or something, or
yeah, red light and yeah, there you go. Red light and infrared. Mine's the combination of two. And it does seem to help. And I've heard some people say in their interviews that it helps to clear the extracellular space. So it can help to clear the move toxins and things. If you're doing all the other stuff, sometimes you need the flushing of the extracellular space and sweating it out in different ways. So super helpful.
yeah, definitely helpful for sure. The main
Oh,
things, I
go
think.
ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry there, I interrupted.
No, I was just thinking, I think those are the main things. And then just mold treatment in terms of mild binders.
Okay. So yeah, and you were affected by mold as well as many people in the community are.
Actually,
And
a major thing. Sorry to interrupt.
yeah,
Get out
no.
of the mold. Get out of the
You're
mold.
allowed to interrupt. You are my guest, so you get permission to interrupt me. Now, if somebody comes in the door, they don't have
They
permission
don't
to
have
interrupt. No, not
it.
right now. They don't. So
Yeah, just get out of the mold is also a major thing that I didn't even think to include. But yeah, I became aware that I was affected by mold suppressing my immune system, and I had a lot of it. It was crazy amounts. I really do attribute some of my recovery to actually getting out of that environment. So something to consider. It's not what people want to hear when you're, your place where you live, to hear that
well,
maybe.
it's terrifying. It's your stability. And there's something, I'm not sure if you're familiar, though, there's something called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And there are basic human needs that need to be met before you essentially go into stress. and you'll start focusing on those things and nothing else until those needs are met. So it's things like air, water, shelter, you know, some sort of connections. I can't remember them all off the top of my head, but it's ter that is a can be terrifying for like for me. I was terrified. I was like, what am I gonna do? I can't leave, you know, right now. Like, what do I do? So I think 100% it's ideal to get out if you can. I think where some practitioners are starting to pivot is they realize, unfortunately, the person will then be homeless and perhaps the elements outside would be just as bad. So they'll recommend certain air filters and things like that. But 100% mold can mess up your ability to fight infections, damage your immune system, and worsen brain inflammation. So if you can, what Alex says, if you can, really focus. I know it's hard and scary to hear, but if you can, think outside the box on ways you might be able to get out of it. I'll let you know, maybe allow people to help you through that process if you have those people, because it really, really can hinder healing, as you say. And in your case, Alex, do you know if you had some multiple exposures or past ones, or was it a current living space type of thing?
It was a current living space at that time. And I just wasn't aware that mold could do that to you. I mean, I'd seen the black mold, but I just didn't know that it could have that effect. It just wasn't on my radar. It's not on most people's radar, I don't think. But I would have been exposed even before that, because I was living largely in heritage buildings that were poorly
Oh,
kept.
yeah. Yeah, older and yeah, definitely. I know what you're saying when you say older heritage buildings. So thank you for that. Another tip. This is so awesome. You have so many helpful insights for people having gone through so much. Now, I'll jump back to a topic here a little bit, and I don't want to keep you all day, although we probably could keep
We could talk all
talking
day.
all day. I'll delve a little bit back into something that was a bit of a struggle for me in previous years. So I'm on approaching year 8 of my Lyme and co-infection battles now. And so years back, not currently, I was living somewhere in a relationship with a person that was not super helpful to my healing process. And so what I'm curious about, because I think that there's a lot of listeners that can potentially relate to this, if it does to you. If it doesn't, that's okay. Did you have any experiences where that factored into the whole mix of the other areas that Lyme and co-infection digs into?
Yeah, I really struggled with this when I was partnered, when I was going through the worst of this. I guess back to our earlier conversation about, the people around us, family members and that sort of thing. You might be gaslit by people that are in your circle. And so that's another burden that's difficult if you're already dealing with it when you're dealing with systems like the healthcare system. To actually have that experience at home as well can be devastating. And I definitely had that. And I was, what I now know, was in an emotionally abusive relationship. There's certain details I can't speak to, but it took a lot to process. And oftentimes, when you go through illness, this is when you really, really see the worst of it. So you might be in a relationship that might be okay or might be difficult, but when somebody gets sick, it really tests your relationships, and you can see things that maybe you didn't see before. It brings out certain things in people. The dynamic changes, the dynamics of power changes when a person is ill. Things change. And so for me, I was also navigating that when I was going through this, and that was really hard. Because again, because of the brain, the brain
Yeah.
injury, all of the trauma and the hard navigation and advocacy that you have to go through. So your resources and your energy is already compromised, and just everything is compromised, your immune system, everything. And then you're dealing with a situation that you have to navigate. It's very, very difficult. And I feel like that might be probably a lot more common than people. I don't know how many people talk about it. I know that I have reached out to people trying to get tips about what do you do. It's not to, I can see that this would be very hard on family members too. They don't have a conceptualization to put this in terms of what this person is experiencing. So I feel if you're in a toxic relationship, it will make it worse. And
Right, right.
if you're not in a toxic relationship, it can be challenging because you're dealing with something that is invisible to, largely invisible to others, that is poorly understood. It brings out those dynamics, and it's heartbreaking when you have to go through it and you're dealing with, something. I don't know what your experience was, but you can't, your plate's already full. And so to be able to process if you are dealing with an emotionally abusive dynamic is just, it's too much to ask. And I feel that people try their best to get, I don't know about you, but when I was going through the active treatment and the worst of the symptoms, it was literally like my world condensed and I had to put blinders on, just kind of focus. You focus on getting to the next day. It's just the next thing. You just, there's a lot of stuff that's happening as you go along this that you can't devote energy to, whether it's fighting doctors or even fighting with a spouse or a partner, right? Around this, you just don't have the resources and you just do your best. You put your blinders on and you try to get to the next step in your recovery. And sometimes it's not until you're out of that initial danger zone of dealing, until you're in the next phase of your recovery where you have a little bit more bandwidth and that you start to like step back from all of those experiences and you're like, oh, now this is, I liken it to hyperthermia or like frostbite, like sometimes the dangerous part isn't when you're freezing, it's when you're thawing. And
Ah, yes,
I
yes.
kind of see that as, when you get to a certain phase of your recovery where you can take a little bit of a breath because you progressed along, but then now you're left to kind of process what actually happened, what happened with around your treatment, the way that you were treated with the system and the relationships. And that can be really difficult as to actually understand. Because when you're going through it, it's too much. It's too much to understand to be able to.
It's way too much. Like it is from my past experience professionally, it is way too much for any person at once, sometimes scattered. It's way too, it's, it is how, still how people come out the other end. And I see it happening is very possible. I don't sometimes, as you said, you said, I put on, and I, with the hand gestures, I put my hands up on my ear. She did actual visual blinders for us here. And that's exactly what I did too. When I was in an unhealthy relationship, I couldn't unpack that, but eventually it ended. And even moving, like it was so hard. Like I moved my stuff in my vehicle. It took 8 trips back and forth. I did it over 2 months because that's the fastest I could possibly do it. I never got around to unpacking anything for probably fully still to this day. So it's 800 times harder. And so when you say, I was going to ask you, I feel you knew, you could sense, she's like, she's going to ask me what I did to get through it. I was going to, but you answered it. You said, I put on blinders and then I waited. My body, in a way, it sounds like your body, in a way, waited till you're ready to unpack it. Because what I've seen happen quite often is exactly that. Sometimes the body disconnects or dissociates because it's a safety mechanism. It's terrifying as heck, because I'm still not sure if I'm going to swear on this podcast or not yet, but I'll decide later on. We'll see. I'll have to look into the legalities around it. What saw, I was ready to go. I was like, great, I get to swear. But I did see a couple of platforms, podcast platforms, and they discourage it. So I was like, I'm going to have to look into this a bit more. So I might swear later. We'll see.
We'll add them
But
in later.
yeah, just like dubbed in a different voice, just like F,
Like
F.
Beavis and Butthead.
Exactly. Yeah. So we could go all different directions with this. But so that's what I want to also let listeners hear is that sometimes the intervention is not this huge list of things. Sometimes you just get through it. You just one foot in front of the other. Sometimes you cry through it. Sometimes you just exist through it, survive through it. But regardless, that's the intervention is surviving. So if I said, what did you do to get through it? You survived. You survived. You did. You survived. And so, Yeah, and then you sounds like you waited till you're able your nervous system. So, kind of to add in what you were saying, you don't always have the nervous system to unpack every problem when you have these illnesses. It's strategic unpacking over the next months, years, and decades. So take that into account.
Absolutely,
Strategic
yes.
unpacking, your body will almost prevent you from being able to unpack certain things. And I really view dissociation, and even in my past experience, I've always viewed it as a protective mechanism. Now, don't get me wrong, you can get too far. I say dissociated to the moon and back. I would have been there, not if had I not got the help I needed. I was getting there. Yeah, I think that that's super valuable information that, there's lots of people, any gender identity that can be in unhealthy relationships. And I think, and I don't know, I'll ask you, Alex, if it was the same for you. I remember being terrified. My body felt terrified. And again, you could say you did or didn't. I just remember like what predominant emotion, if you look back on it, like I was pretty checked out. And it was just, I was terrified. I was terrified. I didn't have money saved up. I kept working as long as I could, and I lost my benefits as a result because I went below part-time. I just remember just being scared. Just like what was there constantly? Fear. I was just terrified, like everything, like the living environment. Was fear dominant for you, or was it a different emotion?
Oh, fear, of course. Yeah, fear, anger also.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, and I feel that can be healthy to have when you're dealing with these type of things, because anger, these emotions tell you something, and anger is telling you there's an injustice that you perceive as happening. So, and it can give you a little bit of energy.
Yes.
And I know, there's a whole bunch of stuff, like even grief, right? Because you're grieving things as you go through this, and you're losing things. You're losing the life you thought you were going to have. You're losing things, and you're not sure, are things going to come back? Like, there's a level of uncertainty that is beyond comfortable when you're dealing with this. I feel like there's a kind of level of uncertainty that one can function with, that can even maybe be a little bit healthy. But the degree of uncertainty that you're forced to navigate when you're dealing with this because of everything and what the context is just frightening. And so it makes sense that you would, shut down, or whatever you do to survive. Your brain goes in fight or flight, and also the impacts of on your brain. They call it like mold brain or something, that you can start to feel angry. I don't know much about this, or if that's true or not, but there's just like a whole bunch of things that are happening. And whatever, even if you're crawling, like at a slow pace, just one step in front of the other, when you're going through that, life does become condensed, and it's like inch by inch. And you're not going to be able to do everything at once that needs to get done. Even now, on what I think is the other end of this, I can't do everything all at once. All these situations I'm dealing with, there's just this radical acceptance of it will get done when I do it. And but in terms of the protective things that your body does, and that your brain does to get through something that's traumatic. So the DNRS, I found this again, I'll say that again, I found it very helpful to do. It also provided positive community, which I think something like this is very isolating. You might be in a situation where you have family members or a partner that doesn't understand what you're going through. So to connect with positive community, and you have to be careful, because when you're going through this, if you kind of over-focus on the horror stories
Yeah.
of other people's experiences, you have to put boundaries around that. And so find yourself some positive community, whether that's through Facebook, whether that's through a DNRS community. That was what I loved about it, is because we actually have a WhatsApp group, and we can reach out to each other at any time of the day to do an exercise. So, and you're dealing with people that understand what you're going through, and can help you out in that way. So I think there are things that we learn to do to survive and to get through this. And that's, yes, sometimes have to put those blinders on and use your attention, what to focus on. It's the one thing that you do have control over, even with the brain fog. You know, you can teach yourself how to do that, or go to a DNRS or similar type of brain training program that helps you to what you focus your attention on, because that is part of the healing when you're going through this phase. Yeah, focusing. It's kind of like I think of my dad when he taught me how to drive. You know, I was driving on the highway for the first time, and I had to drive close to this really big cement border that was right on the side of the road. And as a novice driver, the only thing that I could see was this big giant wall, right, you know, inches from my car. And I was like, I'm so scared I'm gonna like drive into this wall. And my dad said to me, you know, he said, just look where you want to go. Don't even look at the wall. Just look at the road ahead, and you're gonna drive where you're focused on. And it was true, right? When you're driving, you don't look at the thing you don't want to drive into. You look at the road ahead. The thing, you're aware that the wall is beside you, you're aware of that danger, but you're not focusing, you're focusing on the road that you want to go to. And I kind of liken this process to that, is like you're very aware that all these things are happening, you're aware that they're dangers, but you have to focus your eyes on the road that you want to go on, and that will help you through it. And I think that's what you do when you're, you know, kind of in these situations, whether it's dealing with an abusive partner or gaslighting doctors or dealing with all these crazy symptoms, is you try your best to, at least while you're driving, focus on the road.
Yeah, kind of remind yourself what it's all for, a second chance at life, or, you know, just even getting a little bit of a handle on that symptom. Or, and that's all, I don't know what to call that. Should we call that a life philosophy or a quote? Because it's really a nice reminder to kind of weave in there for people.
Yeah, I don't know
We
what
could
to call it. I mean,
leave it as philosophy for now, but yeah, because I do think that's really potentially helpful for people too. And even, to be honest, for myself moving forward with my healing process, I'll probably remind myself of that now. So thank you.
yeah, and just, you know, your brain, gaslight yourself, brainwash yourself in a positive way, is like give yourself messages. That's what another thing that I would do. And that was partly the DNRS thing, but you're feeding your messages when you go through something like this, an illness, like I said, the brain stuff, like you lose your patterns, right? Your brain can't process information. So you do exercises, physical exercises, to train your brain, because the patterns have been disrupted. And there's these things that you do to make those reconnections. And I think it's also with mental health, when you're dealing with something frightening, is that these things disrupt your patterns, right? They disrupt your identity, really, when you go through something like this.
Oh,
It's
yeah,
really deep,
absolutely.
right? You're in the deep
Absolutely.
end. You're like, can I even do what I used to do? Who am I? Like, you get all these
So,
things.
Alex, what are your thoughts on so what you just said there? Like, it's like you're retraining these things. It's like a new identity, like a clean slate. Like, oh, in without th this is not the technical science behind it, but is it almost like in a way for you that it like wiped like a computer? You know, when you do a hard reboot, it wipes it out, and then you have to kind of put the things back in that. Like that's the analogy I'm sort of thinking of. It doesn't actually wipe out your memories and stuff fully and things like that, but you have to make the new connections and stuff and sort of like with the reprogramming. Like some people, they'll sit like I think I don't know who it was, I can't remember where I heard it, but said I'm just out here learning to walk. Like, man, like seriously, like I'm learning to talk. So it's like you're relearning, and those in the brain are re or shaping or making new pathways in the brain. But this how it actually happens is besides, but it just makes me think of wiping something out, a hard reboot, and like some of the things are kind of gone and you have to sort of reconnect them. What are your thoughts on that? It doesn't have to be the same analogy, it could be a different one.
I mean, maybe for some people it is. I think for me, it was more of reconnection. So, you know, like the physical exercises that you do to repattern, you retrain your brain to see again, you retrain your brain to walk, or these sorts of things. You know, you have a visualization of what that felt like, because you know how to do those things before. And I feel like when you go through something like this and your identity, everything is questioned. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, I couldn't read for 2 years. You know, I always conceptualized myself as a well-read, articulate person, and all of a sudden, I couldn't read, and I didn't sound very articulate, and I was saying the wrong words. And You're getting a message from a doctor that this is in your head, and you're getting a message from a partner, as I did, that was, you're an idiot because you said the wrong word. I mean, he would literally, he
Wow,
would
geez.
literally emotionally, say these things, even though he knew that I had a brain injury. So you're getting really negative messages when you're going through this, and be mindful of that, and these are people that don't know who you are. They sometimes have their own agenda that has nothing to do with you. It's not personal, but affects you on a personal level. And I think in the same way that you do exercises to retrain your body to remember or make those connections again, when you're going through this mentally, emotionally, you need to connect to yourself again. That might be something new, like you said, like a hard reboot. It might be reclaiming what you truly are. I mean, like in my case, I couldn't read anymore. Who am I? What can I even do anymore? Then you question, okay, well, who am I? And, is that just, you start to think about identity and you are a person of value, you're a person of worth, and you're going to get messages as you go through this that kind of tell you in so many different ways that you're not worth it. You're getting dismissed with really valid concerns, and these are sometimes subconscious messages that you're getting. And part of the healing is to reclaim that and to remember, the things that you like to do to be able, and that's part of the gas ungaslighting yourself, whether it's with family members or with doctors, is kind of reclaiming your authenticity of, this is what I like to do. These are things I like to do. This is what I like. Yeah, that's what I think so far. That might change. I'm still going through it. So, but those are kind of my thoughts as I kind of make my way through the thawing process of trying
Yep,
to
the
just.
thawing. Yeah. And I like it. It's a straightforward word, ungaslighting. Do the opposite of gaslighting as a strategy. If you don't have access to mental health professionals, basically just do the exact, like if you Google, like what is the exact opposite of gaslighting, you could probably find some answers there. Like validation, writing it
There are
out,
books. There are books there.
kindness. And as Alex said, there's books that actually tell you how to ungaslight yourself. So that's super valid information too. I think kind of what Alex is saying there is, first, again, it depends how long these illness affect you, how severe. For me, it's like it's not a full reboot, but it's pretty darn close. But it is also coming back and now reconnecting to this myself when dissociation and the safety mechanisms make you disconnected so you can survive through it in the first place. I love also that Alex is using the word de-thawing. I also like to use that word because your body just is feels so different. It's you're living in it, but you're surviving in it, and there's a big difference in that. Alex, I'm curious where you're at now with things. So I know you said you're back to work, I think kind of close full-time hours. So you've made that transition. You still got some neurological things ongoing, but it sounds like financially you'll wait, and I'm guessing you'll probably continue things in the future if needed. Or what's next for you with that?
I'm still figuring things out. So I still got one step in front of the other. This illness really dismantled everything. It did everything, like my conception of my future. I think that's a bit of a blank space for me right now as to how to conceptualize the future, because I spent so many years kind of just trying to get day to day, right? And then as you start to make steps in your recovery, your ability to conceptualize in terms of time about, okay, the future and all that. And I'm still at the point where I'm still like, I still have active infections, right? My body is, they're at levels now. I've been able to bring them down to levels that my body can deal with it. But finances has made it impossible for me to afford certain treatments. So I'm trying the best I can to kind of keep the progress that I've made with the resources that I have right now. But I am back at work full time. I fought for that, and I'm getting back to hobbies that I used to like to do. So filmmaking, I've done a little bit of a creative project. I'm dancing, so getting into that.
That is so awesome to hear. I love hearing that because, yeah, I can relate to as you're coming back into life a little bit more and navigating and then seeing what you're actually able to do and readjusting, pulling back a bit and then adding something. But you're adding in your hobbies. So that says a lot about where you're at with your healing journey, that you even care, like you even have the physical energy or mental capacity to even think that you want to go do those activities is a huge step. So that's, I'm so glad to hear that.
I see it as part of my treatment, actually. I don't have the resources to do everything that I would want to do, but it's for other reasons. But it kind of like talking about the surviving things is like you have to look for pockets of joy, and part of the recovery and healing is doing things that you love to do that bring you joy. And for me, I remember when I was crawling on the floor, it was like I remember I would envision, this was during the pandemic too, where we couldn't have these spaces, but I was like, oh, I'd love to be able to dance again and just
Oh.
be in a room with a bunch of people sweaty and joyous and dancing. And so I think, yeah, even if I'm still dealing with some really difficult situations, which I know you and I know what they are, but you have to, as part of your recovery, seek out things that bring you joy from the smallest, even the tiniest of things, whether it's just a really nice cup of hot chocolate or like really focusing on that and giving your body that so that, yeah, you look for it. You look for those pockets of joy and you. That's part of the recovery and the healing is to seek those out as much as you can.
Right. Yeah, and I hear lots of that too, that that is a very important part to have something that's not detox, treatment, appointment, support group, something that's separate from that. It does not matter what it is. As you said, it can be if you have a cup of hot chocolate, it can be literally whatever it is. If if you're at the point where you can allow yourself to sort of be able to enjoy things and different ways and such. So yeah, so to have something like that, it doesn't have to be something extreme. It can even be getting back to listening to your own music and things like that. But it's reminding your brain like, oh, this is what used to keep me sort of satisfied, like feeling good about life before. Like, huh. And so I like your example of the hot chocolate because it doesn't need to be going on a paid holiday somewhere. Awesome if you can afford that. But the reality is lots of us here in this situation, we're not anywhere near thinking about going traveling to a lovely resort. Some of us are, and I'm so happy for them. But I really want to just make that for the people listening because I know there's lots of people that that's a pipe dream for them. So hot chocolate, tea, ginger
Yeah,
water.
just yeah, the
If
simplest pleasures,
yeah.
you focus on those things and you give those things to yourself and you're more than this thing that you're going through right now. You are your identity, your value, your personhood is so much more than this, right? What you're dealing with. And so little things that you can fit in your day as you're dealing with the trauma.
Yes,
To
yes.
remind you of those things, like that's things, that's ancient survival. Like I feel like people through history and time know how to do that and have learned to do that. And I think that's what you need to do when you're kind of going through something like this. Just
Yeah, if you find whatever works, exactly. And for you, is there any positives that came out of having the illness? And then I've got a piggyback question, but I won't bombard you with both at the same time.
I think so. I mean, part of me will say no.
Yeah.
Like I could have done without this lesson.
Yeah.
I think for me it kind of so I have a better understanding where before it was more of an intellectual understanding, but now I feel like a deeper understanding of people who deal with systems. I have been lucky as a person to the age that I am, not to have had largely any issues or negative interactions with systems for the most part. I've never experienced this before, never fell through the cracks in this way. And I realize that that's a privilege that I've had and that I'm lucky that I haven't had that. And it wasn't until I experienced it on this scale with the healthcare system, realized what it felt like to be dismissed, to be a persona non grata in terms of dealing with this, that I really understood, wow, there are people for whatever reason, whether it's their, that they're discriminated against when they deal with systems, whether it's the healthcare system, with the police system, with whatever system, that have this history and that's their everyday reality of feeling like this
Oh
with
my, yeah.
systems that I was like, wow, I'm getting relatively speaking, and this is the impact it's had on my life, it's horrendous, but literally, I've had a small slice compared to what some other people have experienced in terms of their daily interactions with systems. And for the most part, have felt protected by those systems. And I am no longer a person that feels protected by systems. You know, I've experienced what it feels like, and I realize, wow, I realize a little better other people's experiences that have nothing to do with this. I'll just give you an example in terms of people that might be experiencing homelessness. They have to go through a system where they have to do an intake process to be able to access supports. And I've heard that that can be traumatizing because it's recalling trauma. And the very systems that are used to assess people's eligibility for supports that they're entitled to can be re-traumatizing for people. And I realized that coming out on this other end where I'm kind of processing what happened, you know, I've had to, for several reasons that I can't share, but I've had to write several reports and accounts of what I experienced going through this past 4 years, and to actually write that down is almost like experiencing it, and it's been traumatizing to articulate. And I've had to do that to access supports. And that's something to keep in mind too, you know, for somebody who's dealing with Lyme, that sometimes you have to fill out a form to say why you're eligible for certain supports. And that usually means that you have to recount something that's pretty traumatizing. So for family members, you know, if that's something that you can help somebody with filling out a form or being with them while they fill this out, it's something invisible, but it's something really that can impact you, realizing that that's the way the system is set up, and this can re-traumatize people or prevent people from getting access to supports that they're entitled to, because the act of actually the things they have to do and the hoops they have to jump through to get that.
Hoops and backflips, and I don't even know what kind of
Full
acrobatic,
level.
impossible acrobatic movements that no
And
human can
exactly. And you're called upon to do these acrobats and flips and contort yourself in so many different ways to get access to healthcare or supports. And this is traumatizing. And realizing that there are other situations like the homeless population that, you know, experience this like in different ways. And it's not just that, it's just other things. So I think when you have this experience, you can kind of relate that to other experiences that you don't necessarily have, but you can see, wow, I think I understand now what it might be like for these people or that person, because I got a slice of it and it's horrendous.
And
And it
I only want one, a slice, no more.
exactly. But
I'm
it also
not the whole pie. No, 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 no,
exactly. No, I don't want the whole pie.
no.
But it also makes you angry, and it
Yeah.
makes you empathize, and you get to a point where, what can I do so that this doesn't happen? And what can, is there something that I learned that can help another person so that this doesn't happen again? And I think that can happen.
So I heard you say in there. So essentially, you've got a better understanding for other marginalized populations and communities. You can now see it visually and be like, okay, I'm so sorry. I understand that. That's awful. So you have a better understanding of marginalization, discrimination that they would potentially experience also. So that's a positive out of it. And I heard you mention, you know, what can I do? Is there any dreams in the forecast? Like I'll say dreams, not necessarily that are 100% going to happen, but if you had a wand and you said I could do this for the Lyme community and for those in the not in the screens, I did a wand gesture in the screen. What would your dream for yourself and like in regards to if you could make any changes for the Lyme community, what would that one dream be?
Wondering. Well, I
One
have
and a
something,
half maybe,
one and a
but
half.
one. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. Like, that's something that I've struggled with was while I was going through this, is like, how is this even happening? Like, I don't understand this, Stacey. Like, how this came to be. Like, why these barriers, why this is happening, why it's continuing to happen. Like, it just confounds me. And so my brain has been grappling, even as I was angry or depressed going through this, like, how can this change? You know, is it a lawsuit? Is this, you know, but I know for myself, I'd like to hopefully arrange like a fundraising event here in Ottawa for next year. I've reached out to somebody from the Lyme community who is amazing and who did that in their province or their town. And so I'm hoping to get pointers. I'm told it's a lot of
Great.
work. So that would be nice just to raise awareness and maybe raise some money for that. And then I'm wondering if there's something that I could do with filmmaking that might help.
I feel like Canada's a little bit behind in the Lyme disease resources for people external to the system. So I was kind of scooped up by the United States people firstly, and then my practitioners now, they also scoop me up. It's a functional medicine medical doctor and a naturopathic doctor from the States. So I was scooped up by them. But in terms of Canada, I don't see quite as many resources like that. So I think you mentioned there like that, you pondered documentary or something like that. Canada needs that. I will just say that. We need a Canadian-based documentary, and for the listeners to hear that too, there is a need for that 100%, because it would be slightly different. Like, it would be focusing on what's happening in Canada. So that's very important. And I heard you say you're going to do a fundraising event. Also awesome, because that's also needed in some other areas of the world, like some parts of the United States. Like, they have those fundraisers. That's where this podcast sort of, it likes to get its hands on all the things going on. Not that the podcast is alive. That's me. That's me. I like to get my hands on,
Yeah, and
the
for the listeners, for hands just like
field.
whoosh across the
or just da like dancing. It just really depends on the day, but that's really awesome to hear there potentially. And there's no expectation, because with us, we all kind of have to make a pact to ourselves that our health will take priority if it needs to. So whatever your health allows you to do with that, I look forward to hearing about it if you go ahead and move forward with some of those things.
Yeah, I hope it does happen, and I feel like I'm inspired by you and, this podcast, because I remember you talking about the planning for it, and here you are doing it. So I feel like, these little steps that everybody takes, and as you said, it's not in your own time for everybody. Like, I think it's hard to organize because dealing with a very sick population, it's hard to have the energy and resources to fight for systemic changes when you're just dealing on an individual level, something that's devastating. And then also when you go through something like this, and I've experienced this too, is like the last thing you want to think about. If you start to get some gains in your recovery, you want to not think about, Lyme disease, or you want to do other things because you've had your head just immersed in it for like several years and you just want to kind of get on, right? And that is totally understandable too. I definitely take inspiration from, some people that I see, including yourself, that have, made these pockets of change and are doing things that are active. And I feel like that can also be part of healing if that is something that you want to do, is kind of taking something that you felt disempowered and making little empowered steps of doing these things to
Exactly.
take back the story, right? Take back the narrative.
Yeah. And little pockets is exactly, that's how we'll start here in Canada, is little pockets. And as you say, it's a strategic use of your energy, your resources to fight bigger things that take more. So it's kind of, for me, where the podcast game is kind of, this is my passion. It's been in my head for a long time, as you know. And so I thank you for chats leading up to this, because that helped solidify in my brain when I said it out loud. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, it's gonna happen now. I just said it out loud, and I can't remember exactly what I said, but I said like, it's gonna happen now. So
It's happening.
it's happening
Yeah.
literally right now. And so my brain is still catching up to that, and will slowly be catching up to that for the rest of the days here. I would like to thank you for that, because there's all these little pockets that you say that led up to my ability to do this. So many things in the background that other people won't see. People helping me, and some I didn't expect, just free offer, like, hey, I can do this for you, and yourself included, to say, hey, I can help you with this if you need it. And so there's all these little things that go into making somebody still healing able to do this in the first place, and those chats were super helpful, so thank you for those. Is there anything else at all you want to share with people before I toot your horn, like say all the positives that I've noticed?
Well, I've said the positives, but I just want to reiterate again, is just the community, just, I don't think I would have survived this if I didn't have the community. And I would say the other people that are going through this and that I've connected through on Facebook, including yourself, I really want to put that out there that you guys amaze me. Amaze me, amaze me when you share your stories, the victories, sharing your story, sharing what works for you, doesn't work for you. Like, you guys helped me get through this. I reached out. I just remember, like, even like I tweet, not tweet, I would like send a Facebook message from like the emergency room, and there would be, dozens of people responding and saying, you're going to get through this. And I have nothing but gratitude and respect for this community. And, there's certain people too that just work tirelessly in terms of supporting others. And you're one of them. And I just want to show my gratitude because I think that's how we get through this, right? It's not really, I mean, yes, there are doctors out there who are doing amazing things, few and far between in this country, but we know who those names are. And I actually sent a thank you actually yesterday, like filling out your form. I actually was in tears yesterday because I thought about some of what happened, and I actually reached out to a doctor and thanked him because he literally one of the good doctors that, so there are, I think this is what keeps us going, is there's a lot of really negative experiences, but the positive experiences, they do exist, and it's helping each other out and focusing on that, and so grateful. So grateful.
And the community, as you said, it's been so helpful for me too. It keeps you afloat. It keeps you floating.
And I think this podcast you're doing is going to help those pockets that are happening, help them connect with each other. So that's great.
Hopefully we can help keep some other people floating. Like just you and you're sharing your story as well. I knew for a long time that this could really have a helpful benefit just in our brief conversations leading up to it. And so your vulnerability to share all the aspects of it that you shared is so helpful. And so I really look forward to sharing it with the Lyme community and the help that you provided to me in allowing me to tease through this idea of starting this podcast. So, because not everybody you talk to is like, oh, you're going to do a podcast. Some people are like, oh, podcast. Hey, Lacey, aren't you? And I won't say my professional designation just because I'm not going to look into it more if it's good for me to say it on here or not. But they're like, didn't you do school for something else? I'm like, yeah, but this is, I need to do this. Like, I have to do this. So on like behalf of myself, and I would feel pretty comfortable saying thanks on behalf of the community as well for sharing your story. Thank you so much for your vulnerability and openness to discuss, topics that people don't commonly discuss, finances, relationships, brain, all of that stuff. I look forward again to sharing with the community. And I thank you so much for being on the Your Lyme Matters podcast, Alex.
I'm so glad that you're doing this. Thank you.
Awesome. You're welcome. And I did mention that I'm giving you a fist bump
Oh,
to the
fist bump.
screen. Yeah, there you go.
Fist
Thank
bump.
you. I wanted to do it on the recording. I was like, I could do it after, but I don't know if it'll stick. I just felt like for whatever reason, something told me I need to do a mandatory fist bump at the end of this session. And I did. So that's the joy of deciding what happens in the podcast. So yeah. Alex, so I appreciate it. I will end our interview here and thank you so much again.